Welcome to another deep dive.
Oh yeah.
Today we're
I love deep dives.
We're taking you to ancient Scandinavia.
All right.
We've got a fascinating stack of research by Professor Alan Krill.
Okay.
He's a geologist with some pretty radical ideas about who created those famous Scandinavian petroglyphs.
Interesting.
And when
Alrighty.
Are you ready to challenge some long-held beliefs about history?
Absolutely. Professor Krill's work it's really turning the traditional narrative on its head.
Yeah.
Suggesting that these intricate carvings weren't the work of Stone Age artists, but rather Iron Age innovators.
That's right. And he bases this on some pretty compelling evidence.
I've heard.
It all started when he was working with his students at the famous Alta petroglyph site in Norway. Now, you'd expect a geologist to be looking at the rocks themselves.
Yeah.
But Krill became fixated on the carvings. What was it about them that caught his eye?
Well, Krill was struck by the precision and sharpness of the lines, particularly in the depictions of longships, these sleek, powerful vessels associated with the Vikings. He realized that Stone Age tools made of materials like stone or bone simply couldn't have achieved that level of detail.
So he's thinking, hold on, this looks more like the work of a skilled craftsman using an iron chisel, not someone chipping away with a blunt stone.
Exactly. He argues that only iron tools, like the boat nails used in shipbuilding, could have created such a fine, consistent lines.
Yeah.
And the presence of these longships themselves is a big clue.
Oh, okay.
Because longships, designed for long-distance travel and warfare, are characteristic of the Iron Age, not the Stone Age.
Okay. So we've got the tools and the subject matter pointing towards the Iron Age. But Krill takes it a step further, right?
Yeah.
He identifies specific artists he believes are responsible for these carvings.
It's pretty amazing.
It's almost like he's uncovered a group of prehistoric Banksys.
That's a great analogy.
Hmm.
He identifies four distinct artists, each with their own unique style.
Yeah.
And geographic range.
Okay.
Steinstickman, Border Botman, Inge Enrisser, and Audra Umrisser.
He even gives them these cool nicknames based on their style, which I love. Let's start with Steinstickman, the sticker or the stabber.
Yeah.
What makes his work stand out?
Yeah, Stickman is considered the innovator,
okay.
the one who seemingly pioneered the use of iron nails for carving.
Okay.
His style is characterized by thin, stylized figures,
right.
often depicted in processions or aboard those iconic longships.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
Some of his panels include runes from the Elder Futhark alphabet, which was in use around 400 CE.
Wait, runes? So he's not just carving images, he's incorporating writing as well.
Exactly.
For those who aren't familiar, runes are an early form of alphabet used by Germanic peoples.
Right.
This seems like pretty strong evidence to support his Iron Age theory. So where do we find Stickman's work? Did he stay in one place, or was he a bit of a nomad, leaving his mark across Scandinavia?
He definitely got around.
Yeah.
Krill has traced Stickman's movements by analyzing the distribution of his signature style.
Okay.
He seems to have started in central Norway, then moved westward, leaving his mark in places like Nordfjord and Hardangerfjord.
Wow.
What's fascinating is that he even ventured inland to Telemark, but never went around southern Norway, which explains why there are no petroglyphs in that region.
So it's like we're following his artistic journey through these carvings.
Amazing.
Oh.
Okay, let's move on to Border Botman, the boatman. I'm guessing boats are his specialty.
You guessed it. While Stickman was all about stylized figures, Boltman focused almost exclusively on boat depictions, and incredibly realistic ones at that.
Wow.
Krill believes he was inspired by Stickman's work, adopting the nail point technique to capture the intricate details of Iron Age shipbuilding.
It's like Boltman was saying, hey, those stick figures are cool.
But let me show you how a real longship is built. His carvings must be a treasure trove of information about those vessels.
Absolutely. They provide valuable insights into the shipbuilding techniques of the time.
Wow.
And then we have Inge Enrisser, the inliner, who takes a very different approach.
Enrisser seems to be the storyteller of the group.
Yeah.
His carvings going beyond simple objects to depict entire scenes.
He's a good one.
What kinds of stories do we see in his work?
He had the widest range of motifs and styles.
Okay.
Enrisser was clearly fascinated by animals, especially deer, reindeer, moose, elk, often adorning them with intricate patterns.
Okay.
We see hunting scenes, reindeer herding,
uh-huh.
even dramatic depictions of whale hunting.
Wow.
And his work is found over a vast distance.
Okay.
From Finnmark in the north all the way to Oslo in the south.
Wow.
And even stretching east into Russia.
Wow. So he was a real traveler, spreading his artistic tales across the landscape. It makes you wonder what he saw and experienced on those journeys. It's like each carving is a window into his world.
Yeah.
His observations, his stories. Now, last but not least, we have Oddur Amresser, the outliner. What sets him apart from the other three?
Amresser is a bit of an enigma. He had this unusual habit of carving his images on top of existing petroglyphs.
Huh.
Almost like he was reappropriating or reclaiming them.
Interesting.
He was drawn to outlines, whether of animals, boats, or even human anatomy, often leaving the interiors blank.
He's like the rebel artist of the group, pushing boundaries and reinterpreting existing works. Like kind of a proto-graffiti artist in a way.
Yeah.
I love it. And what's fascinating is that he didn't limit himself to just carving.
No.
He experimented with other forms of rock art as well, right?
That's right. Early in his career, he even used red ochre paint.
Wow.
To create his petroglyphs, adding another layer of complexity to his work.
So we've got these four distinct artistic personalities.
Yeah.
Each contributing to this incredible tapestry of rock art. It's just mind-blowing to think about the skill and creativity of these so-called pre-Viking Banksys.
It really is. And what's remarkable is how Krill has managed to piece together these individual artistic identities from these ancient carvings.
Right.
It's like he's given us a glimpse into the minds of these artists.
Yeah.
Their journeys, their inspirations.
But here's the big question. How does Professor Krill reconcile his theory with the traditional dating methods that place these petroglyphs in the Stone Age? That's a pretty significant difference in timelines.
He doesn't shy away from that challenge.
Okay.
In fact, he directly critiques the most commonly used method, shoreline dating, arguing that it's led to falsely old age estimates.
Okay, let's break this down because I'll admit I'm not an archaeologist.
Sure.
How does shoreline dating work?
Yeah.
Why does Krill think it's flawed?
Shoreline dating is based on the idea that as land rises due to geological processes, ancient shorelines become elevated. So by analyzing the elevation of petroglyphs relative to the current sea level, archaeologists try to determine when those carvings would have been above water and therefore available to be carved.
So it's like saying this painting can't be older than the canvas it's on, but that doesn't tell us when the artist actually picked up the brush.
Exactly. And that's Krill's main point.
Okay.
Shoreline dating only gives us a maximum possible age, not the actual age of the carvings. He argues that people could have carved the petroglyphs long after the land had risen. And he has some pretty interesting thoughts on why this traditional timeline might have become so entrenched.
Oh, this is getting juicy. What's his take on that?
Well, Krill suggests that a prominent archaeologist from the early 20th century, Anders Nemedal, who was a champion of the Stone Age narrative, may have played a role in solidifying this interpretation, even if unintentionally.
Now, remember, we're not here to point fingers or make accusations.
Yeah.
But Krill's questioning of Nemedal's work definitely adds another layer of intrigue to this whole story.
It does.
Tell me more about this potential controversy.
Well, Krill has meticulously analyzed Nemedal's findings.
Yeah.
And he points to some inconsistencies in the way certain artifacts were categorized and dated. He suggests that Nemedal's interpretations might have been influenced by the prevailing assumptions of the time, which heavily favored a Stone Age origin for these petroglyphs.
So Krill's not saying Nemedal was intentionally misleading anyone. It's more about how assumptions and established narratives can sometimes shape our understanding of the evidence, even in a field as seemingly objective as archaeology.
Exactly. And this is where Krill's work gets really thought-provoking.
Yeah.
He's challenging us to take a step back and critically examine how we construct historical narratives, even those based on scientific evidence.
It's a reminder that history isn't set in stone, so to speak. It's constantly being reinterpreted and rewritten as new evidence emerges and new perspectives are brought to the table.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And Krill's theory, even if controversial, is a valuable contribution to this ongoing process of discovery and reevaluation.
This is already such a fascinating deep dive. But before we go any further, I want to make sure our listeners understand just how radical Krill's theory is. We're not just talking about shifting the timeline back a few centuries.
Oh, no, yeah.
We're talking about a complete reframing of our understanding of Scandinavian prehistory. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. If Kirill is correct, it means that these ancient artists were not privative hunter-gatherers, but members of a more sophisticated Iron Age society, capable of producing intricate works of art, building impressive seafaring vessels, and perhaps even using written language.
Wow.
It's a game changer.
Wow, that's huge. It completely changes the way we imagine these people, their lives, their capabilities. It's like we're seeing them in a whole new light.
And that's the power of a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
It opens up new possibilities, new ways of seeing the world, and new avenues for exploration.
It's both exciting and a little bit unsettling, right?
It is.
Because it makes you wonder what other assumptions we're clinging to, what other stories we've gotten wrong.
That's a great point. And it's exactly the kind of critical thinking that Kirill's work inspires.
Okay, so we've laid the groundwork for Kirill's theory and its potential implications. But what about the man himself? Who is Alan Kirill, and how did he become so passionate about these ancient carvings?
That's a story for part two of our deep dive. We'll delve into Kirill's background, his journey of discovery, and the challenges he's faced in bringing his ideas to light.
Stay tuned, folks. We're just getting started.
Welcome back. Before the break, we were talking about Professor Alan Kirill's theory that Scandinavian petroglyphs were created. Not by Stone Age artists, as traditionally thought, but by Iron Age artisans.
It's a truly revolutionary idea, and one that hasn't been met with open arms by everyone in the archaeological community.
No.
Kirill has faced a fair bit of pushback. But before we dive into that, I think it would be helpful to get to know the man behind the theory a little better.
Sure.
What's his story? How did a geologist become so fascinated by ancient rock carvings?
Well, Kirill's journey is actually quite fascinating. He wasn't always focused on petroglyphs.
Okay.
His early research centered around glacial erosion and the formation of fjords.
Okay.
It was during his fieldwork in Norway while mapping geological formations that he first encountered the petroglyphs at Alta.
So it was almost by chance that he stumbled upon them. What was it about those carvings that sparked such a passion in him?
Well, as a geologist, Kirill was trained to observe patterns to look for clues that reveal the history of the Earth.
Okay.
He brought that same analytical approach to the petroglyphs.
He was immediately struck by their beauty and complexity, but also by certain inconsistencies that didn't quite fit with the prevailing Stone Age narrative.
Like the precision of the lines, which seem to suggest the use of iron tools.
Right.
And the depiction of long ships, which are associated with a later period.
Exactly. Those details niggled at him.
Yeah.
He couldn't shake the feeling that something wasn't adding up.
Right.
So he started digging deeper, researching the traditional dating methods, analyzing the stylistic features of the carvings.
Okay.
And comparing them to other archaeological evidence from the Iron Age.
So he really went down the rabbit hole, following his curiosity wherever it led him. And the deeper he dug, the more convinced he became that the traditional timeline was off.
Yeah.
That these carvings were telling a different story, a story that had been overlooked for centuries.
That's right. And that's what's so inspiring about Kirill's work. He wasn't afraid to question the accepted wisdom, to follow the evidence wherever it led him, even if it meant challenging deeply ingrained beliefs. He's like a modern day Indiana Jones, but instead of searching for lost artifacts, he's uncovering hidden histories, right?
I love that analogy. He's an adventurer, an explorer.
Yeah.
But his tools are his sharp intellect and his unwavering curiosity.
Okay, so we've got this maverick geologist turned archaeological detective armed with a controversial theory that's shaking up the establishment.
Right.
But let's face it, academia can be a tough crowd.
It can.
How has the archaeological community reacted to Kirill's claims?
Well, it's been a mixed bag, as you might expect.
Okay.
Some archaeologists have been intrigued by his ideas and have even begun to re-examine certain sites and artifacts through the lens of his theory.
So there are some who are willing to at least entertain the possibility that he might be onto something.
Yes, but there's also been a fair bit of resistance.
Right.
Particularly from those who have built their careers on the traditional Stone Age interpretation.
It's understandable, right? When you've devoted your life to a particular field of study.
It is.
It can be hard to accept that some of your fundamental assumptions might be wrong.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not easy to let go of deeply held beliefs.
Right.
Especially when they've been reinforced by years of research and consensus within your field.
So Kirill has faced some skepticism.
He has.
Maybe even some outright dismissal.
Uh-huh.
How has he handled that? Has he backed down or has he doubled down on his theory?
He's definitely not one to back down from a challenge.
Okay.
He's continued to refine his arguments, to gather more evidence, and to present his findings at conferences and in publications. He's even created a website where he shares his research.
Wow.
And encourages open discussion and debate.
So he's taking his case directly to the people, bypassing the traditional gatekeepers of academia.
Yeah.
That's pretty bold. And I think it speaks to his conviction, his belief that he's on to something important.
Yeah.
Something that needs to be heard, even if it ruffles some feathers along the way.
That's exactly right. He's passionate about his work, and he's determined to share it with the world, regardless of the pushback he faces.
You know, that reminds me of something we were discussing earlier about how Krill challenges the traditional method of shoreline dating. He argues that it only provides a maximum possible age, not the actual age of the carving.
Right. It only tells you when the canvas was available.
Right.
Not when the artist picked up the brush.
Exactly. It's like trying to date a painting based solely on when the canvas was manufactured.
Yeah.
You might get a general idea, but you'd be missing the most crucial piece of information when the artist actually created the work.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And it highlights the limitations of relying solely on a single dating method.
Yeah.
Especially one that's based on assumptions that might not always hold true.
So if shoreline dating isn't reliable, what other methods could be used to determine the true age of these petroglyphs?
Well, that's one of the challenges facing researchers who are open to Krill's theory.
No.
It requires a reevaluation of the existing evidence using a combination of dating techniques, stylistic analysis, and comparisons with other archaeological findings from the Iron Age. It's a complex puzzle, but one that's well worth solving.
And to be fair, Krill isn't the only one who has raised questions about the accuracy of shoreline dating.
That's true.
There have been other studies that have shown that this method can be unreliable in certain contexts.
That's true. And it's important to remember that science is a process of ongoing discovery and revision.
Right.
We should always be open to new evidence and new interpretations, even if they challenge our existing understanding.
It's like that saying, the only constant is change.
Yeah.
And that's especially true in fields like archaeology and geology, where we're constantly unearthing new discoveries that force us to re-examine our assumptions about the past.
Absolutely. And Krill's work is a perfect example of how a fresh perspective and a willingness to challenge the status quo can lead to exciting new insights and a deeper understanding of our history.
Okay, so we've talked about Krill's theory, his background, the controversy surrounding his work, and his challenges to traditional dating methods. But I want to bring it back to the carvings themselves. These aren't just abstract doodles on rocks.
No.
They're telling us stories about the people who created them.
Right.
Their lives.
Uh-huh.
Their beliefs. Their relationship with the world around them. What can we learn about these Iron Age artists from the images they left behind?
That's where it gets really fascinating. By carefully analyzing the motifs.
Okay.
The style, the composition of these petroglyphs. Krill has been able to piece together a remarkably vivid picture of life in Iron Age Scandinavia.
So it's like these carvings are a window into the past.
Yes.
Allowing us to glimpse the world through the eyes of these ancient artists.
Exactly. And what they reveal is a society that was far more complex and sophisticated than we previously thought.
Wow.
For example, the prevalence of longships in these carvings tells us that seafaring was a central part of their culture.
And not just any boats, but longships. These sleek, powerful vessels designed for both warfare and exploration suggest a people who were confident, adventurous, and connected to the wider world.
Precisely. These weren't just simple fishing boats.
Right.
They were symbols of power, prestige, and a connection to the wider world. The fact that these longships are so prominently featured in the petroglyphs suggests that they held a deep significance for these Iron Age artists.
It's like they were saying, this is who we are. This is what defines us. These boats are not just a means of transportation. They're an expression of our identity, our aspirations, our place in the world.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And it speaks to the power of art to transcend time and connect us to the experiences and beliefs of those who came before us.
So the longships tell us about their seafaring prowess and their connection to the wider world. What other stories do these carvings reveal? What about those depictions of animals? What can we learn from them?
The animal motifs are fascinating as well.
Okay.
We see a wide range of creatures depicted in these petroglyphs, including deer, reindeer, moose, elk, whales, and even birds. And the way they're portrayed, mm-hmm. often with intricate details and dynamic poses,
right.
tells us a lot about how these animals were perceived and valued by these Iron Age artists.
So they weren't just randomly choosing animals to carve.
No.
There's a purpose, a meaning behind their selection.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. These animals were more than just sources of food or materials.
Right.
They held symbolic and spiritual significance as well. For example, the deer,
okay.
often depicted with large antlers and graceful movements,
yeah.
might have represented strength, fertility, mm-hmm. and a connection to the natural world.
It's like we're seeing the world through their eyes, understanding their beliefs,
yeah.
their fears, their hopes,
right.
through the animals they chose to immortalize in stone.
Exactly. And yeah. it's through these details, these seemingly insignificant choices made by the artists, that we can begin to piece together a richer and more nuanced understanding of their worldview.
It's like we're solving a giant jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
But instead of a picture,
right.
we're reconstructing an entire culture, a way of life that has been lost to time.
Right.
And Creel's theory, with its focus on the Iron Age, uh-huh. provides the missing pieces that allow us to finally see the complete picture.
That's a great way to put it. Creel's work has given us a new framework, a new set of lenses through which to view these ancient carvings.
Right.
Allowing us to appreciate their complexity and significance in a whole new light.
But it's not just about reinterpreting the past.
No.
Creel's work has implications for the future of archaeology as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It challenges us to reconsider our assumptions.
Yeah.
To be open to new possibilities. And to approach the study of the past with a spirit of curiosity and humility.
It's a reminder that there's always more to learn,
yeah.
more to discover,
mm-hmm.
and that the stories we tell about the past are constantly evolving as new evidence emerges and new perspectives are brought to bear.
And that's what makes this field so exciting.
Yeah.
We're not just digging up old bones and artifacts.
Right.
We're piecing together the story of humanity.
Yeah.
Every new discovery,
yeah.
every new interpretation
yeah.
adds another layer to that rich and complex tapestry.
Now, before we wrap up this part of our deep dive,
yeah.
I have to ask you a question that's been nagging at me. We've been focusing on the positive aspects of Creel's theory.
Right.
The exciting new possibilities it opens up.
Yeah.
But what about the potential downsides?
Mm.
Are there any risks or concerns associated with accepting his interpretation?
That's an important question.
Yeah.
And it's one that any responsible researcher
right.
should consider carefully.
Yeah.
One potential concern is that by focusing so heavily on the Iron Age, we might overlook or downplay the significance of earlier periods yeah. in Scandinavian prehistory.
So it's like a pendulum swing, right?
Yeah.
We're moving away from the Stone Age narrative.
Yeah.
But we need to be careful not to overcorrect and ignore the valuable insights that traditional archaeology has provided.
Exactly. It's about finding a balance,
yeah.
integrating new perspectives with existing knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and acknowledging the complexities and nuances of the past.
And it's also about recognizing that our understanding of history is constantly evolving,
yeah.
that there will always be gaps in our knowledge,
yeah.
and that there will always be room for debate and interpretation.
That's the beauty of archaeology. It's an ongoing conversation,
right.
a never-ending quest for knowledge and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And Creel's work,
mm-hmm.
even if controversial,
yeah.
has added a valuable new voice to that conversation.
It's definitely sparked our imaginations and made us rethink what we thought we knew about these ancient carvings. But there's one more piece of the puzzle that we need to address. The resistance Creel has faced from the archaeological establishment.
Right. We touched on that earlier, but it's worth exploring further.
Yeah.
Why has his theory been met with such pushback? And what are the implications for the future of his research? We'll delve into those questions when we return for the final part of our deep dive.
Stay tuned, folks. The story's not over yet. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our deep dive into the world of Scandinavian petroglyphs and Professor Alan Creel's groundbreaking theory about their origins. We've covered a lot of ground already, from the intricacies of the carvings themselves to the challenges of shoreline dating and the potential biases that can shape our understanding of the past.
And we've explored the implications of Creel's theory, not just for our understanding of Scandinavian prehistory, but for the future of archaeology itself.
It's been a wild ride so far, wouldn't you say?
It has been.
But there's one more aspect of this story that we need to unpack. The resistance Creel has encountered from the archaeological establishment.
Yeah, that's right. It hasn't been an easy road for Creel. Challenging long-held beliefs, especially in a field as steeped in tradition as archaeology, can be met with skepticism.
Sure.
Even hostility.
So why has his theory been met with such pushback? Is it simply a matter of academics being resistant to change, or is there something more to it?
Well, it's a complex, as with many things in academia. Part of it, as we mentioned earlier, is the natural human tendency to cling to familiar narratives.
Yeah.
When you've spent years, even decades, studying and teaching a particular interpretation of history, it can be difficult to accept that it might be incomplete or even inaccurate.
It's like having the rug pulled out from under you.
It is.
Suddenly, everything you thought you knew is called into question.
Exactly. And for some archaeologists, Krill's theory does just that.
Yeah.
It challenges their fundamental assumptions about the timeline and the cultural development of Scandinavian societies.
And it's not just about professional pride,
right?
There's also the issue of reputation funding and the potential impact on their own research and publications.
That's true. Academia is a competitive field, and researchers often invest a lot of time and energy building their careers around specific areas of expertise. Mm-hmm. Krill's theory, if widely accepted, could potentially undermine the work of those who have focused on the Stone Age interpretation of Scandinavian rock art.
So there's a lot at stake, both personally and professionally, for those who might be resistant to Krill's ideas.
Yeah.
But let's be fair. It's not just about personal or professional agendas.
Right.
There are also legitimate scientific concerns that need to be addressed.
Of course. And responsible skepticism is essential.
Okay.
In any scientific field, it's important to thoroughly examine the evidence to test hypotheses and to be open to alternative explanations.
So what are some of the specific criticisms that have been leveled against Krill's theory? Where do the skeptics see weaknesses or gaps in his arguments?
One common critique is that Krill relies too heavily on stylistic analysis, which can be subjective.
Yeah.
Critics argue that similarities in style don't necessarily prove a direct connection between different carvings or artists.
So just because two carvings look similar doesn't mean they were created by the same person or even in the same time period.
Right.
It's like saying that two paintings that both feature landscapes must have been created by the same artist, even if they were painted centuries apart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's a valid point. Stylistic analysis can be a valuable tool, but it needs to be used cautiously.
Yeah.
And in conjunction with other forms of evidence.
Another criticism is that Krill hasn't been able to definitively prove the use of iron tools in the creation of these petroglyphs.
That's true.
So
while the precision of the line strongly suggests the use of metal tools, there hasn't been any direct physical evidence, such as iron fragments or tool marks found at the petroglyph sites.
So the skeptics are saying, show me the iron. If these carvings were made with iron tools, where are the tools themselves?
Right.
Where's the residue?
Where's the smoking gun?
Right. And it's a fair point.
Yeah.
The absence of direct physical evidence does create a gap in Krill's argument, one that he acknowledges and is actively working to address.
But here's the thing that I find so intriguing about this whole debate. Even the skeptics acknowledge that Krill's theory has raised important questions and has forced them to take a closer look at the evidence.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of a paradigm-shifting theory like this. It shakes things up. It challenges the status quo.
Yeah.
And it forces everyone to reevaluate their assumptions. Even if Krill's theory is ultimately proven wrong, it will have had a lasting impact on the field of archaeology by sparking new research, new questions, and new ways of thinking about the past.
It's like he's thrown a grenade into the world of Scandinavian archaeology, and even if it doesn't completely demolish the old structures, it's definitely left some cracks in the foundation.
And sometimes those cracks are all it takes to let in the light, to allow new ideas to take root and flourish.
So where does this leave us? What's the future of Krill's theory?
Yeah.
Will it eventually be accepted by the mainstream, or will it remain a fringe idea debated and discussed but never fully embraced?
Only time will tell.
Yeah.
It's too early to say for sure. But one thing is certain. Krill's work has ignited a fascinating debate that is sure to continue for years to come.
And that's what makes this whole story so compelling. It's not just about finding the right answers.
Oh, no.
It's about the process of discovery.
Yeah.
The willingness to question, to challenge, and to be open to new possibilities.
And it's about recognizing that history is not a fixed, immutable thing.
Right.
It's a living, breathing narrative that is constantly being shaped and reshaped.
Yeah.
By new evidence, new perspectives, and new voices.
And Krill's voice, even if it's a dissenting one, is an important addition to that chorus. He's reminding us that we should never stop questioning, never stop exploring, and never stop being curious about the world around us, even if it means turning our long-held beliefs upside down.
That's a great way to put it. And it's a sentiment that we should all embrace, whether we're archaeologists, historians, or just curious individuals fascinated by the mysteries of the past.
So to all our fellow deep divers out there, we encourage you to delve deeper into this fascinating topic, to explore Professor Krill's research, and to form your own opinions about the origins of these enigmatic Scandinavian petroglyphs.
Yeah.
And remember, the journey of discovery is just as important as the destination.
Keep questioning, keep exploring, and keep an open mind. Who knows what other hidden histories are waiting to be uncovered?
That's right. There's a whole world of wonder out there just waiting to be explored. Until next time, happy diving!